Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of October 16th, 2018. We're recapping the major news about U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley's surprise resignation announcement and the critical grand jury report on the State House corruption probe. Also, we look at what to expect in the first gubernatorial debate on Wednesday. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of thinking about scarfing down fair food. Hot take, no one needs a foot-long corn dog covered in deep-fried Oreos. Or, speaking of trash for your body, wondering when I'm going to get my one pumpkin spice latte of the year.
Soon.
Very exclusive. It is my white whale. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And a friendly reminder, our first live taping event is November 1st at Growler House in Greenville at 6 p.m. Snuck that one in there really quick. Number one, Wednesday, October 17th is the last day you can register to vote for the November 6th election. You can easily do it online at scvotes.org, where you can find information about your polling place, see a sample ballot, and more. You can also vote absentee now if you request a ballot. Number two, the state newspaper reports that Senator Lindsey Graham and Governor Henry McMaster will meet with President Donald Trump this week about the future of the mixed oxide fuel facility at the Savannah River site. The plant was supposed to get rid of tons of excess weapons-grade plutonium, but would cost about $17 billion to complete. Trump and the Department of Energy have moved to shut down the project due to delays and overruns. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that Mount Pleasant Town Council unanimously agreed to prohibit food providers from giving plastic straws to customers starting next year. It's a major change to the town regulations that are scheduled to take effect in April, which ban single-use plastic bags and most foam containers. And number four, there is a constitutional amendment on everyone's November 6th ballot that you need to know about. The question asks voters if they wish to make the state superintendent of education into a position appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. Now, if voters approve this measure, it will take effect in January 2023. The measure would finally give governors the ability to campaign on education and then implement their own policies. You can find the entire amendment question at scvotes.org. I just realized something too. We buried the lead. It is not at scvotes.org though. Well, we had a lot of news break last week, so hold on to your butts because we're recapping it today. Some major news stories broke early last week as our podcast dropped, including U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley's stunning resignation announcement. That same day, the grand jury report on the State House corruption probe was released here in South Carolina. Despite happening last week, these stories still have legs and will remain on our radar for some time, especially Haley. Also, we have to take a quick look at the first gubernatorial debate coming up Wednesday at 7 p.m., So joining me to discuss all of this is the Post and Courier's Columbia Bureau Chief Andy Shane and Associated Press Reporter Meg Kennard. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Andy, Meg, you both had big Haley stories last week. You have covered her during her time as governor, her ascension as to the United Nations. Andy, this caught everyone off guard. We all know that Nikki Haley usually has a plan when she does things like this. This is not haphazardly done. And it's interesting to look at Haley's time at the United Nations because she really got into this on her own terms. And we're seeing now she's leaving on her own terms. Break down that situation for us. Give us a little bit of recap and what this means and what the speculation is about what she might be doing.
Sure. I mean, you know, almost 2 years ago, she became the UN ambassador. And obviously it was a surprise because she joined a Trump administration where, you know, a year earlier before that, she was criticizing Trump as she was supporting Marco Rubio in his election bid against him. She's the UN ambassador. I think a lot of people thought she might struggle in the job. She didn't really have a lot of foreign service experience, foreign policy experience. But yet here she is. I think she has basically been given good grades for how she's worked in the UN and how she's adjusted. And of course, also, for the most part, adhered to the Trump policies that he wanted her to do. So her resignation came out of left field. I was actually on the phone with a member of the governor's staff when we both got the news alerts at the same time. She keeps a pretty close circle of folks who she tells things to, advisors, friends, and that kind of thing. I mean, she only told her staff that day. So it didn't really leak out until she was really ready to talk and with the president as they sat in the White House and did it. You know, I think her reason was I've had a hellacious 8 years, 6 years as governor, 2 years as the UN ambassador. It's time for a break. Ironically, her resignation is about the time that she would be finishing up her term, her second term as governor, if she had stayed. Mm-hmm. So it kind of aligned like that. So that made a certain amount of sense. But of course, it did lead to a lot of speculation. What was really behind this, considering she had been doing so well, she had been getting such good marks, and for the most part had really stayed out of the president's, tweets.
Yeah, and especially when you look at, you know, early on in that administration and her time at the UN, she was really kind of a big face for the administration for foreign policy because she was willing to get in front of those cameras and talk about policy, even though she was still just kind of learning on the job. Meg, what do you take away from this? What do you think that her next step might be at this point?
Nikki Haley has had that ability throughout her time as governor and also has her time as UN ambassador to always be looking ahead. This is not an accident. It's not an accident of timing. She's saying a whole bunch of things, but behind the scenes, there are no doubt many other factors that led into her decision and the timing of it. There's been tons of speculation about when is she going to run for president? Not if she's going to run for president, but when will that be? And this, now taking a step back from public office, gives her the ability to go to earn money, which she hasn't been able to really do in the public sector to the extent that you can in the private sector. So she can take a couple of years. She can spend some time with her family. She can stock up some money. And also, she can start using the connections that she's made in the political spheres for a different advantage. Nikki Haley knows what she's doing. Just because we've said this in the same room before, just because we don't doesn't mean that she doesn't have a plan. But she can now start leveraging some of the relationships that she's been making in D.C. around the world and start looking toward when those will be paying off for her in the next step. 2020 is likely not going to happen, maybe 2024, but maybe 2028. Look, Nikki Haley is very young, so she has decades left of public service if she wants it.
Yeah, she's 46, and like you were just talking about the potential campaigns, I mean, she was in the Oval Office, again, leaving on her own terms, had a great exit. She didn't get tweet fired like so many other people in that cabinet had, and she, of course, made that verbal commitment without even being asked that she was not going to run in 2020, she's going to campaign for President Trump.
Doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would you want to run against an incumbent when 2020? You're going to have an open seat.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot more sense. And again, that, as Meg said, it gives her time to get on boards, to get paid for speeches, to certainly maybe
cable
become
news, possibly
cable
write
news,
a book,
possibly be the director of a, or president of a think tank.
Yeah.
Think about Jim DeMint, idea that he left midterm to take over the Heritage Foundation. I mean, she's been in public service, public life for almost 15 years now. Mm-hmm. And her finances, as we covered when she became governor in 2010, as she ran for governor, were not as well-grounded as maybe she would like them to be. And so, obviously, when you spend all that time in public life, it's time to make some money in private life.
Yeah.
As Donald Trump said, I hope she sticks around to help her successor until she can go out and make some money.
They're saying she gets to help get some input on her successor, too. So, again, kind of keeping that, leaving on her own terms, and she's also giving some input on there, too.
Going out on top.
Yeah. And, Andy, you had a column this weekend about how a lot of people kind of pounced on y'all for focusing on the debt aspect of that.
Yes.
Do you want to, was there a reason why people maybe thought you guys were being unfair or something?
Thought the timing wasn't, we need to understand how good a job she did in all of this. And I think the debt, according to her financial disclosure forms, she could have as much debt as $1 million. Now, her staff says that's lower, but of course, and currently at about, they said about $500,000, but these were figures from last year because it's the most current data that she allowed. Of course, they gave us a more updated figure. But that said, folks kind of thought it wasn't really fair to sort of bring that up as a point. But I think that it helps explain, as Meg said, why she's looking to make money with the debt that she has. And the other part of it, too, is that the previous UN ambassadors who served less than 3 years, she's really the only one who just kind of up and said, I'm done.
Yeah.
Most of them either A, got other jobs, they were at the end of administrations, or they were interim UN presidents, UN ambassadors, excuse me, who obviously were replaced by permanent ones. So,
but it's also worth noting that, you know, we did see, there's all that speculation, because that's what you do in these situations, but everyone thought, oh, well, now Lindsey Graham can become the attorney general, and now she can be appointed to the Senate. It's like, I think, okay, one thing, you know, only time she's going to be in D.C. is probably when she's trying to get in that White House, and second, like you said, she wants to make money. There's really nothing there for her in the Senate. I've never heard her express any interest in Washington if she didn't have to be there.
And Lindsey Graham doesn't want to be attorney general. He was very quick to reiterate yet again, look, I'm good where I am. Now, of course, he could always have the cover of, well, the president asked me to do whatever, so I serve at his pleasure. But, I mean, to his credit, Lindsey Graham went ahead and tried to stamp that out pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, and what they were golfing, Trump and Graham were golfing. I saw Jamie Lovegrove tweet this. He said, Graham said, no, I don't think I'd want to be attorney general for me either, is what Trump said after talking to him. So you know how that goes. Switching gears, Meg, while you were working with your national colleagues on the major Haley story, you were also hustling with fellow South Carolina AP reporter Jeffrey Collins on the grand jury report about the statehouse corruption probe that centers on the influence of political consulting firm Richard Quinn and Associates had over the statehouse. And something that Attorney General Alan Wilson, who is named in the report, called garbage and a political attack. Meg, you spoke with Wilson. Give us some more context on his role in this and on this report in general.
Alan Wilson has been very quick to say that he handed off the corruption probe in the very beginning so as to avoid any potential perception of impropriety, any conflicts of interest. Obviously, his longtime political consultant, Richard Quinn, was tied to multiple people in the investigation and then also ultimately charged himself. But at the very beginning, Alan Wilson said, look, this is improper for me to take part in this, and handed it off to a special prosecutor. Now that that special prosecutor's grand jury report has come out, there are allegations within it that Wilson was impeding the investigation along the way. When I spoke with Attorney General Wilson, he was adamant that in no way did he impede things, and he actually turned his statements about the grand jury report into, I think he said, repackaged, recycled political hit job and garbage, basically. This is an election year. The special prosecutor, David Pascoe, is a Democrat. Attorney General Alan Wilson is a Republican. He has long said that he felt that negative statements and apparent vindictive sentiments he was getting from the other side, this is all political. It is to be noted that everyone charged in the probe was a Republican, and David Pascoe is clearly a Democrat. But that aside, Attorney General Wilson took this personally. He does feel that there were inappropriate allegations made against him. He says he is very adamant that he was not doing anything to hold this up. If anything, he was trying to stay as far away from it as possible, but did remind me that his office did still pay for David Pascoe's investigation, and that SLED, the agents that usually work for him when they're doing state grand jury work, were still working for David Pascoe during this time. But even with that, Alan Wilson remains very strong in saying that he stayed out of the way, he didn't do anything wrong, and any conversations that he had with Richard Quinn that may have gone along the way had nothing to do with the investigation itself, which, again, Alan Wilson wasn't part of.
Yeah.
Richard Quinn was his political consultant for a very long time. So there is that connection. But he made it very clear to me in our interview that he feels that these allegations were completely unfounded.
And Andy, just kind of pick up on that, the grand jury did conclude that they said that Wilson put his loyalty to Richard Quinn, who is the political kingpin here in South Carolina and Columbia, with Richard Quinn and Associates, a main political consulting firm, said that he put his loyalty to Quinn over the citizens of South Carolina. Does that ding him again? Like, is that gonna be in a campaign ad we're gonna see coming against him? Or
it already has. I mean, Constance Anusapulo already put out an ad. I mean,
the Democratic challenger
to Alan Wilson has already come out, and I think she will continue to come out swinging against him. I think in the end he ends up in this race ends up being a lot more difficult for him, just like the primary was, which he had to get through a runoff in order to secure the nomination. So this really did him no favors. While he can, what he told Megan, obviously tell folks, you know, hey, I supported this investigation, I paid for it, et cetera. And again, he wasn't, as Meg clearly also, he was not charged, he was not investigated.
Yeah.
He did testify before the grand jury voluntarily. You know, it isn't a good look to look like that you're at all obstructing, possibly obstructing a investigation. Also dealing with someone who pretty clearly became a target of this investigation. I don't know. You know, he talks a lot about loyalty to the Quinns. He still uses a firm that is run by Richard's daughters to help him with his campaign. Again, they were not, it's part of the investigation, unlike his son. son. So it's tough, and some of it is just about appearances, and that's matters a lot in politics. But we'll see how that turns out on November 6th if Constance is able to really make a dent in this. But it's, again, it just turns what should be probably a fairly straightforward re-election for a third term into a slog.
And going forward, Meg, are we going to see maybe a potential impetus here to reform some of these state ethics laws? Again, lawmakers have to pass their own ethics laws here, so that's always kind of an uphill challenge for them.
That's right.
But is this going to give any fuel to any fire starting in January when the next session?
I would say it is inevitable that we are yet again going to have a conversation about ethics reform in South Carolina yet again, because it comes up all the time. And it is very difficult, as you mentioned, to get anything done because these lawmakers are passing laws or trying to pass laws that will govern them and the way that they do their jobs, that deals with lobbying, that deals with access, as Andy mentioned, to them. And it's tough. It is tough to have a sort of self-policing unit when it comes to state ethics here. It's been tried just about every year to try to get substantive ethics reform. It was one of Nikki Haley's big issues that she worked on very, very hard as governor. So I'd say that we're going to have a conversation, but I think it's going to take a lot to actually get through any substantive changes this session or any session to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see some changes in the House Judiciary Committee, at least in South Carolina, next session. So that could maybe prompt some things there, too. But switching gears really quick, we want to wrap up and talk about the governor's race, the governor's debate coming on Wednesday. Andy, you're co-moderator with that, with Charles Bierbauer. Someone who wasn't mentioned in the grand jury report was Henry McMaster, our governor, who does have close ties to RQA. But someone who did was his Democratic challenger, Representative James Smith of Columbia, who's tight with the Quinns. Again, just because he wasn't mentioned, just because he was mentioned doesn't mean they were accused of any wrongdoing. Obviously, James Smith is very close to the Quinns. You know, he worked with Rick in the State House. And again, RQA has worked with McMaster before, but they've cut their ties. Mm-hmm. Andy, does that that was a big thing during the primary. You had all those the Republicans definitely pouncing on McMaster and Smith sometimes there. But I'm guessing we're not going to hear them going after each other on Wednesday about any potential perceived
I mean, James has it in his stump speeches, and Henry, of course, is staying away from it. I mean, in the end, this ends up being a tie, a push, because we're both friends with everybody. Rick Quinn was from Lexington. James is from Columbia, so we're part of the sort of
same delegation,
same delegation, mm-hmm. same area. And they've been friends for a long time. So it ends up being a tie. And I think, personally, I think that helps Henry because, in the end, he doesn't have to answer those questions. That doesn't end up being the half of the debates as it turned out during the primaries. And as an incumbent, if he doesn't have one battlefront to fight on, that means he can marshal his energy for something else. Mm-hmm. I think it's more along the lines of some issues on education that they have differences on medical marijuana and some other mm-hmm. things. But for the most part, you know, this whole State House probe is not going to be a large issue.
For all of the debate over alleged ties to corruption that we heard during the GOP primary, one thing that came from that is that none of it stuck. Henry mm-hmm. McMaster was forced into a runoff, but he won that fairly easily. And so for all of the energy that John Warren and Catherine Templeton and some of the other GOP challengers expended on trying to tie Henry McMaster to the probe, to corruption, mm-hmm. to continuing to remind people of his ties to Richard Quinn, none of that mattered in the end to the voters. So aside from, you know, James Smith's relationship with Rick Quinn in the legislature and any relationship he may have had with Richard Quinn, that notwithstanding, it really wouldn't seem to make a whole lot of sense for him to go down that road because it didn't go anywhere with the primary challengers in the first place.
And none of you mentioned the report.
I was just thinking back to the primary again, that none of it seemed to again, Henry seemed to survive that. And mm-hmm. and again, it's still going to come up as a question. I mean, certainly ethics is still going to be an issue for both of them with that casting of the corruption probe.
And just really quick, Andy, I don't want to know what questions you're going to ask of the debate in case people are listening, but what can we expect? And Meg, I'll ask you the same. What do you want to be watching
for?
Maybe
questions like, what's your favorite fair food?
Yeah. Some people.
Do they think that Clemson is not ranked high enough? Things like that.
Maybe the real tough
ones I'm going to throw at them.
Yeah.
I also promise at some point I will try to ask again about climate change because that was a fun exchange I had with the governor.
Meg, what are you watching for? What do these guys need to do on Wednesday?
I think that this is going to be a time to really be drawing those distinctions. Hopefully we will hear some policy issues come up. As we noted, the corruption thing, it doesn't seem like that's really a worthwhile argument. So really for these candidates to be telling voters to remind them, this is where I stand on these issues. It was pretty hard during both the primaries on the Democratic and Republican side to draw a lot of distinctions because a lot of the candidates did agree on substantive policy issues. Here, where we have one Democrat and one Republican, there's no doubt that there are a lot of issues on which they disagree. Mm-hmm. So making that argument during these debates is going to be something that I feel like they should be using that time to really get those points across to voters because the election is really, really close.
Gotcha. Well, watch Andy Shane co-moderate the Wednesday gubernatorial debate with Charles Bierbauer live from the Francis Marion University Performing Arts Center in Florence. The hour-long debate will be carried live on South Carolina ETV and South Carolina Public Radio stations at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. Guys, we just covered a hell of a lot of ground. I appreciate you. You're rolling with it. Great reporting from the Post and Courier's Andy Shane and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard. Be sure to check out their work and share it on social media. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, time to hit the old dusty campaign trail right quick so we can bring you up to speed on some news regarding statewide political campaign activity. You've probably seen in the news that there's been a swarm of potential 2020 Democratic presidential candidates coming through the state or planning to come through the state as well. That's because, as the AP reports, that the state offers an opportunity for Democratic candidates to test their message on our large black voting population, which is different than some other early voting states like Iowa and New Hampshire that lack those minority voters. So we are an early voting state as well for the 2020 primaries. So that's why we're seeing all this activity right now coming through the state. And guess what? It's not going to slow down anytime soon. We are on that cycle. Well, who we saw so far, though, here's kind of a list of people that we've been seeing filtering through or planning to come through the state. Former Vice President Joe Biden was in town over the weekend campaigning for several candidates. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders will be at an October 20th rally for Our Revolution talking about universal health care, but he won't be campaigning for everyone because a lot of people have said that they don't want to be on the same stage with Bernie Sanders because he does represent a lot of different things that can really sink a campaign more so than it already will in a state like South Carolina. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley will also attend the Sanders event. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker will headline a fundraiser in Orangeburg soon. And California Senator Kamala Harris will attend events in Columbia and Greenville. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg planned to campaign with 1st District Congressional candidate Joe Cunningham. Now, Montana Governor Steve Bullock also planned to do some campaigning with Cunningham as well. California Representative Eric Swalwell was also recently campaigning for Democrats in the state. And Michael Avenatti, who is Stormy Daniels' lawyer, was also campaigning in the state with Democratic congressional candidate Sean Kerrigan. He was attending 3 fundraisers in South Carolina and plans to do more. Now that you know all those names, it's interesting to put in some context here because CNN just released their first 2020 Democratic presidential poll. I'm not going to read all the names again because we heard them. But here's the top 3. Joe Biden is at 33%. Bernie Sanders is at 13%. And Kamala Harris is at 9%. And Elizabeth Warren right there at 8%. But I know that's 4. So just kind of some perspective on what this field's already shaping up and how hard it is for Democrats to kind of get that name recognition in such a crowded field. Busy campaign trail, guys. In our final section, did you know, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some state trivia? And also, did you know, I finally put a win on the board last week for getting one question right. Out of how many times have we done this? I don't know how many times.
Congratulations.
Too many. Millions of times. Thank you, Russ. You're back. And just a little reminder, too, Russ will be up in Greenville with us when we tape at Growler House on November 1st at 6 p.m. So make sure to stop by if you're in the area. If you want to drive up from Columbia, we can get some live trivia with Russ McKinney up there, among other things that we'll be doing that day. So, Russ, here we are. We're back in the studio. Let's get some trivia going here.
Okay. Ambassador Nikki Haley, obviously been in the news a lot of the last couple of weeks. Former South Carolina governor, appointed by President Trump to the U.N. ambassador's position. And really, for such a small state, been a number of ambassadors from South Carolina in recent years. David Wilkins, former House Speaker, was George W. Bush's ambassador to Canada. Bob Royal, banking executive, former Commerce Secretary, was George W. Bush's ambassador to Tanzania. And Dixie Walker, a well-known, longtime University of South Carolina professor, was Richard Nixon's ambassador to South Korea. But there have been other former governors like Haley who have served in major ambassadorial positions. Mm-hmm. So our question is, which of the following South Carolina governors have served as United States ambassadors, not only served as ambassadors, but to major diplomatic posts? Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Governor Francis Pickens, Governor John West, Governor Charles Pinckney, or all of the above?
Jesus. The first all the above I've ever heard. Major diplomatic posts, can you be a little bit more detailed here?
Well, I mean, to a major nation, to a major ally or, you know, a country in the world that's important to U.S. diplomatic relations at the time, not the ambassador to Fiji.
Mm.
An appointment of stature.
We do have a lot of Fiji listeners.
An appointment of stature is what I'm referring to.
Okay, so they are ambassadors?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let me get it again. Pickens.
Francis Pickens, John West, Charles Pinckney, or all of the above.
God, I feel like wrote a story about this previously, we did look at previous famous South Carolinians. I can't remember that entire list off the top of my head, but I don't remember seeing that many names.
Well, a couple of those do go way back.
Yeah, so. I was going to say. Most recent one I can think of is West, so I'm going to go with him.
Going to go with West. Okay.
Even though, let the record show, I do want to say all the above just for the hell of it, but I don't want to gamble that big.
Well, let the record show, you should have said all of
God
the
above. God damn it!
You should have said all of the above. Governor Francis Pickens served as ambassador to Russia. He was appointed in 1858.
Oh, yeah, I didn't get that one.
Yeah, Governor Charles Pinckney was the U.S. ambassador to Spain, appointed in 1801. All these were very important times in U.S.
Sure.
relations with
Pre-internet.
Those particular countries. And Governor John West was President Jimmy Carter's ambassador to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Appointed in 1977 at a time of critical relations in U.S. relations in the Mideast. So all of those former governors, and there have been other former governors that have served as ambassadors.
I'm going to give myself a half point because I hedged that. I know you probably can't do that, but Russ plays tricks, so I can play tricks, too. That was really interesting and informative, Russ. Good to know those things. I should have known the minute you said all the above that was the answer. But I knew West more recently and knew his background a little bit more. So, Russ, thank you again, and I'm glad to see that I've returned to my streak of losing.
You're welcome.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways South Carolina ETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams at scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV every Friday at 7:30 p.m. or Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android phone and the NPR One app or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, where you can see photos from the studio on assignment and, of course, our awesome memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scleadpod. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on October 14th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. I can't. can't go to the state fair because I'm a compulsive pig race gambler.